Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, Canada's first online financial news and research service, providing insider news and knowledge to investors. His website, CanadianInsider.com, home of the Canadian Insider Club. Welcome back to the show, Ted.
Jim, thanks for having me back, and thank you to everyone listening in.
Ted, how are insiders reacting to this volatile market we're experiencing?
Yeah, it has been quite volatile, hasn't it, around the turn of the month. And insiders in Canada use the pullback as an opportunity to buy in some key areas. And it's something we don't see very often. In fact, I can't, aside from a complete market dislocation like we had in COVID and the great financial crisis, I don't remember seeing what we've seen early this month, and that is insiders in both the energy and tech sectors, now we're talking Canada, not the U.S., increasing their buying. We've seen our energy indicator jump from, at the beginning of August, it was around 100%, which is still pretty good, but it's now over 300%. What does that mean? 300%, there's three times as many stocks in the energy sector with key insider buying as there are with selling. So that's been a big move in about a month. Technology, where we had basically in August, there was twice as many stocks with insiders selling as there are with buying, that's flipped. And it shot up to, we've got the indicator now at 172%. So there's more than 1.5 stocks with key buying for every one with selling. And so that's a big improvement for the technology sector. Now, I just want to add one caveat in the technology sector. As we wrote in our morning report earlier this week, there is one major exception to that energy buying, and that was on our September 11th report, so people can pick that up on CanadianInsider.com if you're interested to know which big name that was. Sure, some can probably guess. But we're seeing some of the smaller ones, cloud service providers. We highlighted one on September 10th in our morning report where we've seen some insider buying. So it's interesting that we've got both the tech sector and the energy sector with insider buying, because they're kind of at the opposite ends of sort of the economic spectrum, but certainly the industrial value chain perspective. You've got energy resource extraction. Now it's a lot higher. It involves a lot more technology than it used to, and I don't think the energy sector gets enough credit for the innovation that goes on there. But that being said, in terms of how it's viewed by fund managers, it's seen as a very economy sensitive type of a sector. And you've got the tech sector, which is I think it's also economy sensitive, but it's also innovation sensitive, interest rate sensitive. It's a little more complex. It's more of more of a complex sector in terms of how institutional investors will look at it. So it's not often you see our indicators in both of those areas jump. So it's encouraging, and it's helping overall insider sentiment in Canada to move higher. We've got our Ink indicator, which across the board in Canada on the TSX. It's over 100% now, so more stocks with insider buying than selling. So that's a nice place to be. Now, one thing I would say is that it's important to keep in mind that insiders are reacting here to changes in price momentum. And until we kind of see a peak insider buying where it looks like we've had the maximum insider buying, you could still see some weakness in share prices. Doesn't mean we will, but because they're now buying the dips, basically, until we see the peak insider buying, we won't have a lot of confidence that the dip may be in place, that the support levels for the stocks may be in place. And usually we don't get that confirmation until sometime after the fact. So, but it's heading in the right direction for the bargain hunters out there. Yes, insiders are bargain hunting, and so there seem to be some opportunities in this pullback. So, and we've seen kind of the energy stocks bouncing back a little bit here. So we'll see how much further that has to go. We are in a seasonally weak period for energy. Will there be more weakness ahead, or as all the kind of gloomy end of summer driving and worries about U.S. production, has all that been baked into the price? We'll have to see. But insiders certainly picked up their buying in the Canadian side of things. So that's an encouraging development here as we work through the late summer, head into early fall.
Right. We have Hurricane Francine, who's gone through the Gulf of Mexico. They had to shut down refineries in Louisiana. And isn't that where a lot of Canadian crude ends up, Louisiana, to be processed?
Well, a lot of Canadian crude heads into the Midwest for refining. I'm not sure if the crude would be impacted by that situation. I think some of the natural gas, we do have some natural gas now that makes its way down to the Gulf. But, you know, I think these hurricanes are short of a massive devastation on facilities. These tend to be temporary impacts. I think, you know, over the longer term or medium term, I don't want to say longer term, but over the next 2 years, I think what's more important is whether these LNG facilities, export facilities come online, notwithstanding, you know, these storms that come through the Gulf once in a while. If we get a new administration in the U.S. that's anti-LNG exports, then that would be not a good thing for Canadian producers because, it would back up the price. It would put downward pressure on the price in North America if there were limited export opportunities, despite LNG Canada, which is the big Canadian export facility that's scheduled to come on stream next year. But if American export facility development slows, that would not be positive. However, at this point, that does not seem to be the case. But, you know, we do not yet really know what the Harris policies are on much. So we'll be hopefully getting a little bit more of an idea on where she stands on those types of issues. And we know Trump, I think, is quite pro development. So I think, you know, certainly a Trump win would be positive for Canadian natural gas producers over the medium term. You have to offset that in the short term. If there is more drilling in the Permian and the like, you could get more natural gas being produced. So you could have kind of conflicting factors, but it would be positive to get more LNG facilities built, that's for sure.
The polls in Canada have the Conservatives way ahead of the Liberals and NDP. Would that change the attitude towards the Canadian oil patch if Pierre Poilievre was Prime Minister?
On the margin, it could. I think that, first of all, you know, we don't know if we're going to have a fall election. We'll see. I'll be surprised, pleasantly surprised if we do, because I think Canadians deserve an election at this point, but that's my opinion. In the meantime, you know, I think the Canadian the oil patch is primarily, you know, the development is primarily provincial responsibility. We've had the feds kind of poking their nose into it with their climate policies, and they have managed to get at least the Trans Mountain pipeline finally built. That's been a big help. And we're going to have the LNG Canada, the export LNG. So, you know, I think a lot of the fundamentals are in place now for Canada, the Canadian oil patch. So I think the U.S., both the political situations, both countries matter. I think Canada actually is a bit more on the margin. What would be, I think, a more significant concern is if we did have an election, and I think this is a very unlikely scenario, but not impossible. If we did have an election, we did have a return of the Trudeau government for another extended period, you could have tougher climate regulations, and I think that would not be an invigorating development for the Canadian oil patch, but that is not the base case. That is a bit of a long shot, but I think that is the bigger risk, that there would be more climate regulations. And of course, if Polyev were to come back in, there would probably be some unwinding of some of those. So, but I think again, there's some complex issues there as well. But on the margin, I think the bigger risk would be having another 4 years of climate regulation being put on the oil patch from Ottawa. But I think that's, as I said, not the base case.
AI uses a lot of electricity to, artificially become a human brain. Apparently, it's a complex structure that it's amazing that we run it on so little energy. But do we have the infrastructure to support AI in Canada, or are we right at the brink right now of not having enough power?
Well, Jim, that is an excellent question. And I say that because I think Canada is well positioned to capitalize on this investment boom that's happening in AI, and regardless of what one's view is on it, I mean, we're starting to use it in Ink Research a little bit. We're putting out some experimental videos. You should follow our CanadianInsider.com Twitter feed, or go to our blog. You can sign up for a free account, Canadian Intro account on CanadianInsider.com, and you can get our blog posts. And we're posting Ink Spots, which is AI-generated video. It's kind of experimental, but we do put some key investing themes. We're going to be doing one in a day or two on an oil patch stock that's had some buybacks, done quite a bit of buybacks, so keep an eye out for that. We've had one on a REIT, office REIT was our first one. We've looked at the correlation between tech and gold stocks, which is another one. So anyway, we put out some interesting, they're just short, there's a minute and a half, but keep your eye open for that. But back to your question. Look, these AI data centers for the servers that process all these large language model learning processes, they require tons of energy. Well, Canada still, is pretty good when it comes to having nuclear power and energy sources, and we can build it out. So we have a tremendous opportunity. But, with many things in this country, I'm kind of despondent about our focus, and, we don't seem to be at a policy level all that successfully focused on capturing this opportunity, and we're relying on the big American companies to come in and set up things, and that's not very creative. And instead we chase the EV battery dream, and look where that's gone. We've all of a sudden, we now apparently we don't need EV cars because the federal government is taxing them. Instead of encouraging adoption of EVs, yes, I know that they're from China, but if you want to generate enthusiasm and infrastructure for electric vehicles, maybe you should encourage. And if you believe that they're important to solve climate change, I'm just saying, if that's your government's position. And last time, well, a year ago, 2 years ago, that's all I was hearing from the Trudeau government was how important EVs were to the climate transition. But apparently this year, they're not as important because they're putting 100% tax on imported EVs, which is going to put the price up of all EVs and slow down the development of EVs domestically. It just will, because there's no competitive threat or a smaller competitive threat. The domestic producers are not going to move as fast. So we've had an about face on EVs from Ottawa, yet we've spent billions supporting EV batteries, and what are we doing on AI? In the meantime, we've kind of just let the big American tech oligopolies run the show. We don't seem to have a vision in terms of what we could do in Canada. So, you know, meanwhile, our productivity struggling, GDP per capita is falling, you know, and yet, you know, we hear Ottawa talk about dental care and farming care, and that's, you know, where the wealth is supposed to come to generate all this. I guess it's that's fallen back to their immigration plan, which is now, of course, having to be pared back. You know, they've been relying on population growth to drive GDP, but unfortunately, GDP, because there's no productivity growth in Canada to speak of, GDP hasn't been keeping up with population growth. So we're getting poorer as a country, as individuals. Maybe the economy, I know some economists will get up and say, oh, no, but the economy is growing. Yeah, the economy is growing, but per person, which was what matters, is going down. We're all getting poorer. Jim, I think unfortunately, every interview we do on House Street, it's like every, you know, 4 or 6 weeks, you and I are both getting poorer because our per capita GDP in this country is going down, and all our listeners in Canada are getting poorer, right? Yeah, there's some exceptions. You know, some are doing better than others, but we're all getting poorer, and that's directly as a result of the policy choices made by the NDP Liberal government. It just is, you know, and this is not a partisan statement. It's just an outcome. It's just how you could believe that, well, it's all going to turn around and this is just temporary. Okay, that's fine. Well, that's up to the NDP and the Liberals to make that case that's what they believe. I don't, you know, I'm at this point, I'm like, show me the money, and the money, unfortunately, of per person in Canada is getting less and less. Yet, our focus tends to be on social programs and how we're handing out new handouts, but not so much on how these programs are going to be funded. So we're missing a big opportunity, I think, on the AI side, and we bet heavily on the EV batteries, which we've now decided that it's not so important. These EVs, you know, that's just how reckless this Ottawa thinking has been, and I do, though, want to give the Ottawa a bit of slack, just a little bit, not much. Is they are getting a lot of pressure from Washington to do this policy, and we do have an integrated auto industry. So I understand that there are pressures for what they did, but, you know, Europe took a more of a moderate approach in terms of their tariff policy on EVs with China. So there were choices there to be made, and the choice that the Trudeau-Singh alliance made was to put the price of EVs up and make them less affordable for Canadians, which is going to drive down adoption. You know, I give Bob Hoy a shout out. You know, he was on this a year ago, and he just happened, you know, he had a helping hand here from Ottawa. But Bob has been, calling for, you know, kind of peak EVs here for a while. And now he's got Justin Trudeau helping him on that. So, but Justin Trudeau is still spending billions of dollars supporting the industry. So it's unfortunately, that's the outcomes that we're living with in Canada right now. And I think you will see investments in EVs. In AI in Canada. It's by American companies, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, I was looking forward to being able to buy a Volkswagen Viking EV from China that, at the time I read the article, was $10,000 for a basic little urban runabout, which is, if you live in Vancouver, that's all you need. Most people don't make long trips here.
Right, so this gets down to...
Now it's 20 grand.
Is it the climate? Assuming they're going to bother shipping them to Canada, and because there's other countries that are taking them, and it comes down to what's the emergency here. I thought there was a climate emergency. Now I'm just going by what I've been told by policymakers. Well, now apparently there is no climate emergency. It's a overcapacity emergency from China, which is complete nonsense. I mean, look, if there was not demand for EVs globally, and if we no longer had a climate question. And again, this, I'm talking about this from a policymaker perspective, not, you know, whether there is or there isn't, but we still hear this narrative from Ottawa, from Washington, Europe, well, that there's a climate emergency problem. Well, if there is, it doesn't make sense that you're trying to make EVs more expensive. Well, at the same time, making the cost of driving an internal combustion engine car more expensive. So this is all turned into some kind of a revenue, not just a tax grab, but it's more than that. It's becoming a reallocation of money in the economy from winners to losers. And unfortunately, the losers are consumers, and the winners are certain vested industrial interests. And that is what has unfolded in North America. And, you know, I think we need an election in Canada to have this out, because, I think that thanks. Anyway, I mean, the fact of the matter is that people, I think, are now waking up to this kind of, not waking up. I mean, I shouldn't say that, because this EV tax has just, they just put it in this year. But I think people will do the math in Canada, and it doesn't add up. You can't, on the one hand, claim to be a government that's cares about the climate, but at the same time, you're putting the price of EVs and making them more unaffordable. It just doesn't make any sense. So, and you have a carbon tax at the same time that you're making EVs more expensive. So this does not make sense. And I think we should have an election to see if Canadians want this, where we're getting taxed on both electric vehicles and regular combustion engine vehicles. Does that make sense? Do Canadians think that's a good way to run a country? I think we should have an election on that. And if Canadians in their wisdom decide that that's the way they want to go, then, you know, that's the way we go. But somehow I think that's not the way the average Canadian was going to vote.
Now, of course, the government used the word tariff. Maybe people don't understand what a tariff is, that it's not the country where that product comes from that pays the tariff. It's the consumer in the country that receives that product that pays the tariff, right?
Absolutely. And, the costs are can be absorbed by either the consumer or the producer. But in this case, because there's not a huge amount of competition in the EV market, and there's not a huge supply of EVs in Canada, like if you want to go and buy an EV now, good luck. The consumer will be paying, because the government is encouraging EVs, and there are a lot of people who want to buy EVs because they just believe in it. That's fine, you know, but there's not a lot of EVs to buy, so the price will be at the maximum possible that the producers can charge. And so it's going to be the consumers that pay, the Canadian consumer. It's not going to be China that pays for this. It's not going to be, you know, it's just going to be the person who buys the car is going to pay.
I really wanted that little 10 grand Viking.
Why not, right? Like, why should it be $20,000? But, you know, anyway, that's why we should have an election, to have that discussion, you know, have that debate. Does that make sense for Canada? You know, does that make sense?
There's so many votes from the auto industry workers, though, in central Ontario, that, of course, they're going to be protectionistic because they need those votes.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, that's a big part of the equation. But, there's other ways of, there are other ways of handling it. But that's not, that's not my my concern. That's the concern of the politicians. They can, there are other ways to support the industry. And again, you know, Ottawa has not made the case for adoption of EVs. They've said is there's a climate emergency, we're going to throw a bunch of money at it, and we need EVs, but we don't need them that badly apparently, because we're going to put the price up on them, and we're going to, you know, basically make them harder to get. And, you know, and maybe in 5-10 years, once we're able to produce them in North America, then you can have your EV. But, you know, that doesn't fit with the climate emergency timeline that we've been told.
Productivity, you said Canadians are lagging. What can we do to improve our output?
Well, that is a big question, and there are lots of opinions out there on it. And I saw I'm not going to say who it's from, but it was from a policymaker in Canada retweeting a paper that was published last year, which basically bemoaned that we had too many small businesses in Canada. And I just want to put this idea that small businesses are the problem of productivity to rest, okay? Sweden and Belgium, for example, have a lot more small businesses than we do in Canada, okay? And their productivity is higher, okay? So just stop with this blaming small business for being the problem. Okay, I just want to like put that out there. If you hear anybody talking about, oh, well, you know, we have too many small businesses in Canada, we just need bigger businesses. I'm sorry. You can have a lot of inefficient big businesses as well. So that's not the solution. You know who likes this solution about having bigger businesses? It's bigger government, because they can do bigger programs and they can do bigger bureaucracies to deal with bigger businesses. And basically, that's not the approach that, in my opinion, that we should be taking. How about getting rid of reducing regulation, for example? That would help. How about redoing the tax structure to make it more, to encourage more investment, as opposed to maybe increasing the capital gains tax? I, you know what I mean? So I think there's things you can do that have nothing to do with company size. And I would just be very, very circumspect when you hear any policymaker, any academic start saying we need bigger companies in Canada and that's going to solve our productivity problem. There are broader approaches that can be taken and quicker, and that, but the bureaucracies don't like them, because it usually means smaller government.
Now, in both Canada and the U.S., roughly, isn't it about 70% of jobs are created and provided by small business?
Right. Well, these people who want the big business solution will just say, well, it should be bigger. You know, it should be, you should have more bigger businesses. I just ask you, how many people, does the Meta platforms employ? How many people does Amazon, well, not Amazon, but, Google employ? How many people does NVIDIA employ? Not a lot. They all make good money, and those companies really help juice productivity levels in the United States. But does it benefit the average American? I'll leave that up, I'll leave that for the American listeners, to discuss and think about. But, again, it comes down to the results for the economy versus the results for the average citizen in the economy, and they can be quite different. And, that comes down to equality and who participates in the economic growth. And, those are big questions. And again, that's why I think we should have a meaningful election in this country. And I hope it comes down to some policy discussion that are meaningful and not just, lost on certain, emotional issues, which, politicians love to kind of boil election ballot questions down to, because those are easy to debate than complicated problems, which we have a fair share of complicated challenges in Canada, and we should really get our heads around it.
Well, an idiotic taxation policy in Vancouver is, if you're a small business that's in a two-story building, say a popular restaurant or pub, you are taxed at the rate of the zoning, which is, if you're in a zone that allows 50-story buildings, they tax you like you're a 50-story building, not a two-story building. How much economic sense does that make? Because several popular places have gone bankrupt or out of business because of that taxation policy. How smart is that?
Well, Jim, that's just one example of changes that could be made at the policy level that don't cost anything to make. Now, you can argue, well, you're going to lose tax revenue on some of those changes. Well, that's a discussion. Again, that's why you need to have ideally a discussion about tax policy, like what should we be taxing? And that's a difficult discussion to have. And it's a tricky, and so politicians would rather talk about social touchstone issues, and talk about things like gun control, right? Which, are Yeah, gun control is important, but you know, last time I checked, criminals weren't having a hard time getting a hold of guns if they wanted it, and you know, it's a peripheral issue in terms of the overall quality of life in Canada, you know, in my opinion. Yet, you know, we've got this collapsing productivity, collapsing per capita growth. You want to worry about crime? Well, you just let your economy continue to collapse on a per capita basis, and you'll see what happens whether you have gun control or not to the crime in Canada.
Yeah, desperate people do desperate things.
Yeah, it's survival, you know, exactly.
Haiti's the prime example of that, isn't it? Where the gangs have taken over the country.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, that, hopefully we're not heading towards that kind of outcome. But you know, I mean, we don't have to. I mean, we should be going forward as a country, right? Not backwards, right? Like people should be getting a little bit wealthier over time, not a little less wealthier. But this is what's been happening. And so we've need to determine as a country whether we're okay with this slow erosion as baby boomers get older and as their children, you know, face the prospects of having a tougher time than their parents have. You know, it's time to have a meaningful election in this country to discuss these things.
Well, I think most politicians haven't heard of the Laffer curve, which shows that the more a government taxes you, the less money there is to make the economy grow. You get the most economic growth when the taxation rate is around 22%. But the government in Canada is pushing it over the max. In some cases, it's more than 45%, you just make less and less money.
Governments have an incentive to bring in as much revenue so they can redistribute it and increase their importance in the economy. That allows the importance of you know, their jobs to go up. That allows them to get paid more. So it, in a sense, you know, bureaucratic policymakers, like those who are career policymakers, they will act in their own self-interest, and it's up to our politicians to manage that in our interest. But I'm afraid, you know, there are some governance issues with the current representative democratic system we have. We give people, representative members of parliament, our proxy vote basically for 3 or 4 years, and then, you know, we have very little influence over that vote. So however, a vote is coming, whether it's this fall or this next summer, or, you know, I think next summer is the deadline. We will have a chance to, as Canadians, hold these policymakers, MPs, to account. And I hope we do. And I hope we don't get bogged down into some kind of distraction issues, which politicians will try to do because it's easier for them. And again, that's them acting in their own self-interest. So Canadians, voters, have to be, it's up to us as voters, right, to act in our interest and to press the politicians for meaningful solutions to the situation in this country. And if we don't, then we will continue likely along the same path that we're on.
How greedy are Canadians' federal politicians? They push back the mandatory election date by a few days so they could all get their maximum multi-million dollar pensions. So wasn't that greedy? No, of course not. We'll have more with Ted Dixon right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Dixon. Ted, the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, are talking about creating a new currency called the unit that would be 40% backed by gold. Do you have any idea how much that could impact us?
Well, we have a very, very important BRICS meeting coming up at the end of October. It's the 22nd to the 24th of October. That's the 16th BRICS Summit. It's in Kazan, Russia. And this is where they will provide us with more guidance in terms of their project to promote the use of their currencies in international trade. And as we, I believe we've discussed in the past here, one of the options they're looking at is a BRICS currency, digital currency called the unit. It's not the only option they're looking at. But I would encourage everyone who has any interest in either gold group, gold mining, or foreign exchange to read our July 26th blog post on CanadianInsider.com. It's called "Will BRICS Countries Come Together in One Unit? Why Gold and Gold Miners May Win in a Multinodal World?" And it goes through the details in terms of, in midsummer, where things stood with the unit development. I believe the development is continuing to, in a pilot state to see if this project is going to be taken to the next stage, and we will get, I believe, or expect we will get some guidance on that from the Kazan meeting, and it'll be very important because as we outlined in this post, that with the 40% backing of the unit by gold, it will require some significant amounts of gold to be put on reserve basically forever to back the unit currency. So that if this unit project becomes viable, and we're not there yet, there's a lot of work that has to go through, it has to be taken. We're not at a sort of a minimum a viable product stage at all. We're at the pilot stage. But if it were to start to get some momentum, you know, we would be laying the foundation for gold to be basically back front and center into, you know, the world monetary system beyond just its current reserve status with central banks, which is important. But this would be, the unit would require gold for essentially commercial transactions. So whereas right now gold is, you know, used for many things, obviously, you know, individuals can hold it, jewelry, but central banks hold it as reserves. If the unit currency, the BRICS currency, were to get some traction, essentially you would have commercial traders. I mean traders, I don't mean speculators, I mean those trading goods and services, would essentially need to have, and I'm kind of cutting through the details here, but essentially the outcome is that gold would have to be put on reserve, you know, if you wanted to use the unit as your form of currency in these transactions. So again, you know, we kind of explain the ecosystem, how it would work in the document. So please take a look and read it. It's not like, I'm not saying that, you know, if you're a soybean farmer in Brazil and, you know, you're selling to a food processor in China, the Chinese food processor isn't paying you in gold. That's not exactly how it works. But the outcome is basically that in order to pay in units, there would have to be gold on reserve to back that unit. So, in a sense, gold is being used, would be used in trading activity, merchandise trading activity, and that would be a big change from gold today. So it's how gold is used. It would be an addition to how gold is used today. So, it would be big developments. This is a very pivotal fall, I think, for the global economy, geoeconomic trajectory over the next 5 to 10 years, how the BRICS summit goes. It's not getting near as amount of attention in the Western media as it probably should. There'll probably be a bunch of stories close to it that probably will only, I don't know, who knows how who knows how it'll be characterized. But, you know, I'm looking at it primarily from a gold miner perspective, how it could impact the gold industry. And whether they use the unit or not, you know, gold should continue to benefit from BRICS promotion of local currencies in trade, because even if they do not use a unit, they will likely use a form of a kind of wholesale central bank digital currency so trading house to trading house. I'm not talking about a CBDC that tourists would use. That's not the idea here. That's not the focus, I think, in terms of what the BRICS are looking at. They're looking at basically at a wholesale level. But if they were to use even their own local central bank digital currencies, whether it's, Indian rupee or, Chinese renminbi, Russian ruble, they would still need to back it with gold to give it value, right? Because, if you're going to be a counterparty and you want to accept, you're going to accept a CBDC of your trading partner, it has to have some stability, and gold is a good way to help anchor that. So either way, gold will, it has been, I think this is one reason why gold has had a bid over the past year, not just purely on speculation. The Fed has done raising interest rates. I think that's part of it as well. But if you look at the divergence between gold and silver, gold is, outperformed silver quite substantially. And I think part of it is because gold is at the center of attention when it comes to the BRICS in terms of it helping to support the use of local currencies in global trade. So this is a very important period for the gold market, and we see that reflected in the fact that gold is at all-time highs.
Well, China, India, and Russia have been stockpiling gold for the last 10, 12 years. I guess this is what they had in mind. Meanwhile, the UK and Canada sold off all their gold at bargain prices several years ago. Are we going to live to regret it?
Well, I think basically the trend in Canada and UK has reflected the hyper-financialization of our economic system, whereas, the developing nations, they haven't had that luxury of being able to just sort of print money whenever they want to finance things, and engineer things, so financially engineer wealth. So, it's more or less been born out of circumstance, and the unintended consequence of the sanctions on Russia, with the Russia-Ukraine war, has been to, incentivize Russia to basically work hard at getting, this local currency promotion mechanism, going. And it was always an objective of the BRICS to do, always, but recently it was an objective of the BRICS to do this. But now you've got a very motivated actor called Russia. I don't think that was a policy objective of the sanctions. And I think, Donald Trump understands that the sanctions have kind of gone a little too far, and he's, favoring tariffs instead of sanctions. So it will be interesting fall if we have a Trump victory and a BRICS outcome. It'll be interesting regardless of who wins the U.S. election. So it's going to be a very interesting fall, and we'll be paying close attention to what happens, what comes out of the BRICS summit at the end of October. It's going to be very, very important, and, particularly for the gold group.
Yeah, now, when a government decides that it's just going to print money to solve its economic problems, Zimbabwe, the prime example of how it goes sideways. One U.S. dollar is equal to 35,000 Zimbabwean dollars, and they're printing $1 million Zimbabwean notes. The zeros look pretty impressive, but mean nothing.
Well, I can't imagine what the price is in gold then. It must even be
trillion.
So, the U.S. has been able to do the money printing because it's the reserve currency. And, Donald Trump understands the importance of maintaining U.S. dollar in in global trade. And I gotta think that the Biden administration understands it as well. They seem to have two different approaches in terms of how they plan to do it, sort of. But, you know, I think that the other reality of the matter is that in the U.S., if they want to revitalize their manufacturing, it's going to be hard to do it with the U.S. Dollar being the major reserve currency, because there's always going to be this essential need to run a current account deficit in order to provide the world with enough dollars, you know, for them to hold as reserves. So they're kind of self-defeating. You know, being a reserve currency is it's not all as cracked up to be. I mean, it's given them this opportunity to run these big deficits. I mean, boy, you know, you look at the U.S. economy and it's, you know, it's pretty resilient, but, you know, their budget deficit is huge. I mean, what we're doing in Canada, you know, I mean, it's minor leaks compared to, you know, the deficits that the Trudeau government is running is in minor leaks to what the U.S. government is running, the Biden administration is running in terms of percentage of GDP. You know, the U.S. budget deficit is running about 6% GDP, round figures. Canada, I think it's around 2, you know. So, I mean, you know, I stand to be correct on it, but it's not 6, you know, it's not 5, you know, it's not 4. I mean, it's at least half of what the Americans are running. So, and I know we've got provincial debts and all that, but just in terms of Ottawa, the U.S. has this big ability to run these deficits because they're the reserve currency. So that's good in that they can keep taxes low, they can, you know, build their military, and they can do other things, but they can't build their manufacturing base because that's just not the demand. The default position of being the reserve currency is you're basically supplying the world with dollars. That means you're importing things from the rest of the country, the rest of the world. So, you know, for the Americans to change that, they'll probably have to reduce their budget deficit. They'll certainly have to, you know, reduce their trade deficit. Now, that's going to be a painful adjustment. How they, you know, so it'll be interesting to see how they tackle it, if they do tackle it, or if they just let the, you know, the status quo kind of prevail. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see. This may not work out as poorly as, you know, as the media will probably try, and at least some media will try and probably portray BRICS as being the enemy, and, you know, they're trying to, you know, de-dollarize, and you're going to hear a lot of that. But, you know, if the Americans want to reinvigorate their manufacturing, you actually want to kind of probably, you know, have the U.S. dollar, you know, you don't want it to be dumped as a reserve currency by any stretch, but you kind of might want to manage it down a bit. And, you know, the BRICS initiative is not going to happen overnight. You know, it's not like all of a sudden, if they do the unit's going to become, you know, a major challenger to the U.S. dollar overnight. It's going to take many, many, many years for a BRICS currency to get into circulation and into adoption. I mean, this is not going to be an overnight sensation by any stretch. So, you know, it could work out okay if the world is able to sort of refocus on diplomacy and talking to each other as opposed to, you know, conflict and sanctions. And it would be good if we had a little bit more diplomacy and probably a little less conflict, and you know, and we could start talking to each other a bit more than we've been doing, as opposed to these blocks that don't talk to each other too much. And let's just see how once the U.S. election is over, then there will be some breathing space for U.S. policymakers to act in, you know, in the interest of America without having to worry about, you know, an election the managing issues that come with that, the PR managing issues. There'll be some, whoever wins will have some political capital to make some decisions. So we may be in a better place once we're past the November 5th election, and you know, assuming we can get a policy, an administration in there that's willing to kind of use its political capital to advance those things that, you know, Americans apparently want, you know, more manufacturing. And so there's a way to do that, I think, that, you know, can work for, you know, for everyone to some extent, but it will require some, a bit more diplomacy, and hopefully that's what we'll see in the future.
Canada's capital gains tax changes, what kind of an impact is that having?
Well, I it's not going to be positive. It's just come in, but, if you're looking at, you know, if you want to encourage capital investment to boost your productivity, you know, increasing the tax on capital investment is just not the way to go. I mean, it's just quite irrational, actually. So,
Ted, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Jim, thanks for having me back.
My guest has been Ted Dixon, CEO and co-founder of InkResearch.ca, his website, CanadianInsider.com. If you have any questions for Ted or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com, HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.